This is Cincinnati Edition. On 91.7 WVXU, I'm Michael Monks. Dozens of doctors and healthcare workers arrested or charged in the latest federal crackdown on prescription opioids in the nation's history. Coming up, how did the investigation develop? Plus, a new study shows more people than previously expected may be impacted by the construction of the new FC Cincinnati soccer stadium, what the numbers say. But first, a federal magistrate's ruling that Ohio's method of lethal injection for prisoners sentenced to die amounted to cruel and unusual punishment has Governor Mike DeWine halting executions until a better method is found. Let's talk about it with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight. Welcome back, Cameron.
Thank you.
If you have questions or comments about this topic, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments or your tweets there. Cameron, what is the method for lethal injection that Ohio was using?
Well, so there was a three-drug cocktail that was used in the most recent execution of Robert Van Hook, who was a Hamilton County person, actually. And it's the one drug that the magistrate that, you know, the death penalty, anti-death penalty advocates have brought to kind of focus on is midazolam, which is kind of used to render people unconscious. Basically, it's there were arguments at first that it was like kind of had a pain-killing effect, but there's experts who argue that that's not true. And in the case of Robert Van Hook, and experts say in other cases as well, it causes pulmonary edemas, which is why the magistrate kind of made those bold statements. And he said that it was when you suffer a pulmonary edema, it's tantamount to being waterboarded, frankly, in his opinion. So that's sort of where the one drug that's focused on. But we've had a number of different drugs combinations used in the past, and with varying not so great results. And we did use a two-drug cocktail for a person named Dennis McGuire, his execution in January of 2014. And that execution took 26 minutes, and it was apparently a pretty brutal sight to witness. And after that execution, the death penalty was halted for basically 3.5 years. So we've had these stutter steps with the death penalty for about the past 6-7 years.
So the federal magistrate had to determine that the feeling of waterboarding was amounting to cruel and unusual punishment. And that's how he reached his – how does he go about reaching that decision? How do you compare the feeling that somebody on death row is feeling while this is going on to understanding how somebody feels when they're being waterboarded?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's based on sort of the expert testimony that's been brought in on this ongoing lethal injection litigation that's been happening for years and years now. I was actually subpoenaed and compelled to testify in the case regarding the Van Hook execution because I witnessed that. And while I mean, I obviously can't, I didn't go forward and say, oh, I felt like he felt this or felt that, because I have no way of knowing that. There's doctors, there's autopsies, there's all these things that go into this death penalty litigation that was presented to this magistrate. And he decided to make this ruling to continue kind of the process of the lawsuit, which involves basically, I would say, almost everyone on death row has some kind of party to this lawsuit. So
what is Governor DeWine asking for now?
Well, DeWine just said we're suspending it because we want to look at it closer. And the overarching kind of theme is that he just wants to get it right. He feels like it needs to be right. But there are anti-death penalty advocates in the state who feel like if anyone could kind of bring the death penalty in Ohio to a stop completely, DeWine could be the one to kind of lead the way on that, because he has been he's been an Ohio AG, which, you know, their office is basically has a huge role in prosecuting death penalty cases. He's been a prosecutor at the county level. He's a Republican. There's no part of DeWine's record that has been light on crime. So if he were the one to kind of bring forth a proposal to kind of move away from the death penalty completely, he doesn't have all that other baggage that a Democrat or someone without his background would have.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you have questions or comments about this topic. You touched on this earlier, Cameron. This isn't the first time Ohio's lethal injection method has been questioned or stopped. You mentioned the execution of Dennis McGuire back in 2014. He was convicted of raping and stabbing to death a pregnant woman, and his death took 26 minutes. He struggled, gasped for air, and choked for about 10 minutes before he died, according to the reporting. That was when the state used something called pentobarbital, and then the manufacturer stopped selling it for that purpose. So now the state had to deal with that situation. It's got this new situation on its hands based on the drugs that it uses during lethal injections.
Right.
Where do they look for what's next? Are there states who can serve as an example?
It's really hard to say because a lot of states have gone away from a lot of states don't have the death penalty anymore. And in the case of this, I mean, the hunt for drugs is a big part of it because and I spoke with Tim Young, who's at the Ohio Public Defender's Office, and they do a lot of work defending death penalty cases. They're sort of on the other side of the coin for prosecutors. And he made it pretty clear that the drug efforts were basically driven by the market. He said that these companies just don't want their drugs used and refuse to sell them. And he said it doesn't take any advocating on the part of anti-death penalty people for them to do that. A lot of these companies, he said, are based in Europe. Many European countries don't have the death penalty. And the standards and ethics that these companies hold themselves to are sort of on the face for them. They don't want to be involved in this.
In your reporting on this, in an article you co-wrote with Jesse Balmer, you wrote about a man named Jeffrey Wogenstahl. He was convicted of killing a 10-year-old girl, Amber Garrett, back in 1991, and her body was found days later in Indiana. He had beaten and stabbed her. So that was 28 years ago. He was supposed to be executed on Wednesday.
Correct, yeah.
But now he has an indefinite stay?
Yeah, so I think Wogenstahl's case sort of demonstrates the complexity and some of the elements that anti-death penalty advocates sort of point to for their for the arguments against the death penalty, and that it takes so long, it's so complex. Tim Young, the man I mentioned at the Ohio Public Defender's Office, said it was an extremely wasteful process. And Wogenstahl has been in an appeals process since his conviction, and it has taken years and years for them to look at this case. This is a Hamilton County case too, and he has three open cases right now at the county level, at the state level, and an appeals level. He's got these three cases that so just it keeps going and going. And in his case, I think it shows that these cases can play out for so long.
So when the death penalty is reinstated in Ohio, if it's reinstated in Ohio, how quickly is someone like Wogenstahl put back in line?
Like you mentioned, he has an indefinite stay that's separate from this DeWine suspension. So the suspension could potentially affect people depending on how long it is it drags out. But his stay, I mean, he'll have to go through these three court cases, will have to be resolved, and then if he's successful in some of these cases, he could get a retrial, and then who knows?
Okay, so he's benefited from a couple of different possibilities for sparing him from execution at this point. How many inmates are we talking about overall here that are at least temporarily spared by this?
Yeah, so it's over 100, I believe it's around 130 that are on death row right now.
And is there any impact on these inmates' legal challenges or appeals? Does this sort of idea that this may be cruel and unusual punishment now give them more leverage in the appeals process?
I mean, it could buy them more time. I mean, there are some cases where the appeals process might be at a point where they might get a little bit more time on their cases or something like that. But it's hard to say. It's so complex.
And I just want to note that you found that the average time spent on death row is just over 17 years. Is that because of the appeals processes?
For sure. That's a huge part of it. Robert Van Hook was on for over 30 years. And I think that average is actually probably – because we've only – since the death penalty came back in the 80s in Ohio, we've only executed a little over 50 people. So that average, I think, has been brought way down by the couple of volunteers that we've had in the state. There are people who refuse to appeal their cases because they, for whatever reason, feel like they deserve to die. And those cases are the time between conviction and execution can be as short as like maybe 2 or 3 years in those cases. But those are people who they're legally called, I mean, the legal system calls them volunteers. So it's sort of a different sort of case.
Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters also weighed in on this. What did he have to say?
Well, he had some bold words. He felt that it was he feels that the argument is sort of being misdirected. I think that I think he would agree with me when I say that. And he says, if you want to get rid of the death penalty, that the judicial system and these lengthy, long appeals aren't the way to do it. He says, elect legislators who want to get rid of it, and that's the way to do it. He also said that it shouldn't, you know, it's not a pretty thing. The death penalty is you're killing someone. It's not a pretty thing. It's not going to be a clean kind of situation. So, you know, dancing around all of these issues is sort of complicated. There was also a national Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty doesn't have to be painless just recently. In Ohio, that might not matter because the Ohio Constitution says it does. So there's a lot of interweaving things, but Dieters had bold words. He said, bring back the firing squads if necessary. And he also suggested that we have a bunch of seized fentanyl and other opioids that, you know, could potentially, you know, are known to kill people that, you know, stockpiled in police departments all over the state. So
513-419-7100. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Bob on the line. Hey, Bob, how are you? Is Bob there?
Bob is here. Yeah, I'm going to sound like a me too. I'm not in favor of the death penalty, but if the state's going to kill people, why don't they pick up some of this carfentanil from the street corner? The Chinese manufacturers don't seem to have any problems with it killing Americans.
Bob, that's exactly the point that Cameron just raised that was being made previously. So we appreciate the phone call, and thanks for your perspective. Cameron, before I let you go, I want to touch briefly on another article you wrote with WXIX reporter Stefano DePietrantonio. A woman named Ashley Foster spent 7 days in jail in Brown County, during which time she lost her job, she lost her kids, and this was all due to a case of mistaken identity by Aberdeen police.
That's the understanding that we have right now. Fox 19 broke the story late last night, saying that there was this case. They interviewed her, and she said that she was released and told that the charges were dropped and given no real explanation. My contribution to this story was that I spoke to the Brown County prosecutor this morning, who verified to me that that it was indeed a case where an open warrant in a drug investigation was filed against just a person with the same name. It was just they filed it against the wrong Ashley Foster. And then on Wednesday, which would have been just a day or so, the same day that the Ashley Foster we're speaking of was released, Aberdeen police put a Facebook post up that said, you know, we have this trafficking investigation going on, and here's the people who are involved. They named Ashley Foster. They put up a mugshot that doesn't appear to match the photos of the Ashley Foster we're referring to. And on Wednesday, they said both subjects were still at large. So it seems like that they're sort of saying that the person that they're actually looking for is still out there. So yeah, it's a very odd case that's still developing. We are trying to find out where her kids are at the moment. It's pretty standard protocol for JFS, Jobs and Family Services in Hamilton County, to place kids with family if they can find them. So there is a chance that the kids are already with their family, but it's hard to say. We're still working on it today.
We've got another call. We have Christina on the line. Hey, Christina.
Hello.
What's your question or comment?
Well, I appreciate the topic. But just to clarify, the guest said that most European countries do not have the death penalty. All European countries do not have the death penalty. Only countries like China, Saudi Arabia, Iran, North Korea. I think we get what I'm going after here.
All right. We appreciate the call, Christina. Thanks so much. We did get a note from our producer that says Belarus is a country that conducts executions.
So I think we're on the same page there.
Okay, Cameron, we appreciate you coming in and talking about these today.
Thanks so much.
Just ahead, a look at the federal investigation that led to charges against dozens of doctors and healthcare providers, including one from Sycamore Township in the nation's largest crackdown on prescription opioids. And later, a tweet from a Cincinnati City Council member about the fire at Notre Dame Cathedral and the arsons at black churches in Louisiana gets lots of responses. We'll break them down. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A Sycamore Township doctor is among the dozens of healthcare professionals charged in a federal crackdown on prescription opioids. What triggered the investigation? Let's discuss with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Terry DeMio, who joins us on the phone. Welcome back, Terry. And in the studio is WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. Welcome back, Tana.
Thanks for having me.
If you have questions or comments about this case, give us a call, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments or your tweets. Terry, what caught federal investigators' attention to kick off this sweep?
Well, there was a big intent to do something big with the strike force that they founded in October of 2018, the Appalachian Regional Prescription Opioid Strike Force, which included five states, including Southern Ohio and parts of Kentucky. And they just decided, you know, we know this is still happening, that there are rogue prescriptions, overprescribing going on, and we're going to take a good look at individuals who are prescribing lots and just didn't look like they were doing the right thing.
How did it work? What were investigators looking for, Terry?
Well, they were looking for anybody who prescribed too many pills, pain pills especially, but also benzodiazepines. Those are like the Xanax and the Klonopin, things like that. And what they did was they started with analysis of the prescription data monitoring databases, because every state has one of those. That's where doctors are supposed to check on patients' prescriptions and where they're getting them from and make sure they don't have too many. But many of these doctors were on that that type of database. And so the feds decided to look and see what looked kind of funny, what looked kind of wrong. And also they checked Medicare and Medicaid billing and the Department of Defense health care benefits billing to see if there were people that looked like they were getting money for things that they shouldn't. And after that, they did boots on the ground kind of investigating.
And Tana, a local doctor, was caught up in this. What do we know about him?
I can't speak to the one in Sycamore Township, but I can speak to the one in Dayton, who was considered at one point to be the highest. He had prescribed the most opioid prescriptions in the state. He was found to have prescribed 1.75 million pills over a two-year period. So what they allege is that he was actually operating. He had a pharmacy in his waiting room, and he was kind of running the pill mill right there out of his office in the Dayton area.
And Terry, what can you tell us about the Sycamore Township doctor?
As it turns out, this is a man who currently doesn't have enough money to provide for his own defense. Excuse me. He was overprescribing, apparently from 2015 to 2019, according to the indictment. But he is also the subject of a lawsuit by a family who says that an individual in their family died from accidental overdose, and it was an individual to whom this doctor, Dr. Nashang or Nashang of Sycamore Township, had prescribed opioids.
Tana, have we seen anything from patients of any of these doctors involved? Any reaction to how they are surprised or
whatever they may feel about their doctors being arrested?
I haven't seen anything, but we haven't been covering it from that angle. Terry, have you guys been doing that?
You know, I've noticed some of the comments and gotten a few direct messages from people saying, oh, yeah, this doctor, you know, I'm not surprised this happened to this doctor. People just kept going back to him. I stopped using him, or this was the rumor. That's about it. But I thought, Michael and Tana, it was very interesting to me that for the first time ever with one of these investigations, the feds, you know, put CDC people, public health officials at the whatever clinics were left up, left empty, to try to intercede and help people who might be coming by to get pain pills, to help them with their addiction.
Terry, over the years, as the region has been ravaged by a heroin crisis, we hear reports about the role played by opioids in pill form, often prescribed for pain. What do we know now that perhaps we didn't know before about the role that this medicine has played in the epidemic?
Well, you know, I think that we know that in Southwest Ohio and Ohio itself, pain pills, overdose death by pain pills had declined significantly in the last couple of years as heroin and fentanyl overdose death, well, I'm sorry, heroin overdose deaths have declined. And fentanyl is the main, you know, the main killer. It is the most powerful synthetic opiate out there, or forms of it. But what we're seeing is that, yeah, this is still a huge problem. I think that the prescribing and the people misusing opiates is just, it's still, you know, a big thing. And there's, it is still, for those who become addicted to them, you know, a gateway drug to the other types of opioids that are out on the streets.
Tana, at this news conference, was there any indication that there's more to come?
Yes, they did say that they're expecting more arrests. So the work continues of the strike forces. There's a local office here in Fort Mitchell, I believe, and some more regional offices around. And they say their work is still ongoing. They expect more to bring more people in. Yeah, indeed.
Our thanks to Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Terry DeMio and WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. This is Cincinnati Edition. On 91.7 WVXU, I'm Michael Monks. FC Cincinnati soccer stadium construction may impact more West End residents than previously thought. A tweet about privilege by a Cincinnati City Council member drew varied reaction on social media, and a local school was shut down by an invading raccoon. Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge joins me in the studio to break it all down. Welcome back, Sharon.
Hi, good to be here.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you have questions or comments about these topics. You can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll find your comments and your tweets. Sharon, I want to start with Councilwoman Tamaya Denard's tweets. I want to read part of what she wrote on Tuesday as Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris was burning. Quote, "I'm saddened that the beautiful cathedral in France was damaged, but this is a prime example of privilege. White people don't have to see me if they don't choose to. Black people don't have a choice. Please read Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison." She goes on to say, "It's possible to hold multiple truths. I'm also saddened that black churches in Louisiana were burned down. I'm sure they held significance as well. They were barely acknowledged. This is bigger than whether or not you heard about the black churches being burned or not. It's about the unfairness of how the importance of the black churches have been conveyed." So Sharon, Denard was talking about the arson at three black churches in Louisiana, allegedly at the hands of a sheriff's deputy's son who was motivated by racism, according to national reports. What has the reaction been to this series of tweets by the councilwoman?
You know, she really sparked a conversation. I wasn't sure what was going to come out of a story like this, but that was so much very in the news that day, the cathedral fire. And I'm sure she was seeing what I was seeing. I myself posted a picture about how sad I am. I went there in 2015. And, you know, it's just amazing part of Paris. You can see it from so many places. I climbed to the top of it and I posted a picture from there. And her point, her point was, you know, but what about here at home? And she didn't see the same level of things. And people, you know, they wanted to voice their own opinions, which a lot of people said, it's not the same. It's not the same.
She went on to expand upon her original comments. What did she say when she came back around to it? Anything that changed her original narrative at all?
Well, she just really explained herself more. She has been, so we're, you know, a voice for disparity on council. This is not the first time we've seen something like this. She is speaking for people who haven't really been able to speak for themselves. And there's other people I do have, you know, I noticed over the next 2 days, you know, for the churches, there's other people kind of said things that she did. And it raised a lot of money for these churches and their rebuilding, too. Like, that voice helped there. And she just was trying to explain that, that's what she meant.
Yeah, that's right. Her comments didn't really exist in a vacuum. There were others on social media who shared a similar sentiment outside of the councilwoman's tweet stream. And then you got reaction from Joe Mallory, the vice president of the Cincinnati chapter of the NAACP. What did he say?
He backed her up. You know, we're trying to be very careful about, like, covering issues of race. And, I reached out to him to see what he was thinking. And he felt the same way she did about a lot of this, and that the voice matters. And, you know, this big attention to a cathedral and not the same for the Black churches. And he likened it to music hall.
Yeah.
And how we have... in the museum center and the money that we've put towards, you know, saving our own icons here, and which is a lot of money. And that sparked even more conversation because people are like, well, rightly so. Of course, we need to preserve our treasured buildings. And so it gave people a lot of fodder to talk with. I haven't had a story like that in a long time.
Let me read part of Mallory's quote. He said, "Look at Music Hall or Union Terminal, the landmarks people value. They will leave no stone unturned to improve them and make it better. If something happened to Music Hall, I guarantee they would rebuild it. Clearly, there is not a lot of value placed on Black life. There's no investment in trying to uplift the Black community." That was Joe Mallory, NAACP vice president here in Cincinnati. And then the Inquirer published a back and forth between a couple of columnists, Jason Williams and Kevin Aldridge. I also want to read part of what Aldridge said towards the end of this back and forth. That's one of the reasons why I dislike social media, he said. 280 characters doesn't leave a lot of room for nuance or context. There are difficult conversations that we need to have, and I can respect elected officials pushing us to have them. And since you're here, Sharon, let's talk about the soccer stadium.
Okay.
How about that? This seems to be a recurring theme
right
when you come
it.
In. What do we learn about this new housing study by the Port Authority?
You know, honestly, so we don't have the housing study yet. The housing study is underway now. It's
That's the $150,000
study. It is. Yeah. Paid for by FC Cincinnati at the request of, you know, people who want to make sure people aren't displaced. And the team agreed to do it. This is going to be a parcel-by-parcel look at the West End. And, I can't wait to see it. But in the midst of, we heard, you know, from a 99-year-old woman we've talked about here before who said, you know, spoke out that she was being displaced, and we heard some other residents who live around here, they showed some preliminary data to council. And, you know, it was fascinating. It said, you know, that the people in this neighborhood are all in market rate houses and who are renters are already at risk. Let's not pretend that the people aren't going to be displaced for the stadium, but of course. But this study really looked at who's living there, and it talked about just the risk anyway, because it's such a poor neighborhood. You know, just a little bit of things can go wrong and force people out of their homes and their apartments. And so that was kind of the gist of the data that we saw.
Any idea from that gist on the percentage of residents or the number of people that may be impacted?
Hold on, I brought the numbers because these numbers are super important.
They are. And again, I want to reiterate that this is a $150,000 study paid for by FC Cincinnati. And these preliminary data were released by the Port Authority. Did you find those numbers?
I don't have them in front of me.
But
you know
okay.
what? It is 100% of the market rate renters are at risk of being displaced, and 75% of the people who own homes. And it is one of our smaller neighborhoods. But, you know, that is a scary change for a neighborhood. And there was a promise that nobody would be displaced
right.
for this stadium. And I think that's kind of like the underpinning of what people are saying. It's like, well, you said that nobody would be, and here we are.
That's what I want to know next, is what has the reaction been? Has there been a lot of "I told you so" reaction from West End community members?
No one's using those words specifically, but I don't think they have to. It has been their message. You know, I was looking at it today for a story that'll maybe post later or Monday, that, you know, we're talking about 14 people. The stadium site expansion, they're talking about moving it north onto Wade Street, and there's at least 14 people living in some of these buildings that are at risk of of being displaced, and they don't want to go. And they have advocates that are speaking on their behalf saying even they shouldn't even be moved to other places in the West End. And this is going to have to be a conversation that our city council has.
So what happens now? I mean, how long do we wait for this study to come out?
Well, the study's coming out in July, but you know, the city can do things right now to talk about displacement ahead of like things that are happening with the stadium. If you put it all, I mean, the point that they're making is like you have to make some legislation and talk about displacement now, like after the stadium's already approved and built. It's too late to be talking about it. The conversation has to happen now.
You also wrote that there's a Jehovah's Witness temple that's also being impacted here. What's the story with that?
You know what? I would love to know. It is. It's on that northern portion. I know for a long, and you know, I've been asking about these properties kind of as we've been going along over the last year, because it's like, there's some big things right there in the backyard of the stadium. And I know that the Jehovah Witnesses had said they did not want to sell. And then all of a sudden they did. And I have not talked to anyone there yet. You know, they've been very quiet and not always answering their telephone. But I'll be interested to see. There are some other Kingdom Halls around Cincinnati, and I don't want to guess for them like what their plans are, but they did sell, and we don't know the price either. And the team, honestly, they don't have to tell us. We don't know the price of a lot of things that are being sold, but you have to think these properties are pretty expensive.
Our producer, Selena, just sent us the numbers that I think you meant to bring in.
Thank you, Selena.
So she says that 1,491 renters are at risk, as well as 352 homeowners. So those are some pretty significant numbers.
And yeah, and that would change the face of this neighborhood. I met a woman this week, 92 years old. She's lived in her house 72 years. And she's like, you're going to have to carry me out feet first. And she's like, I don't want to move. And the same conversation, the same kind of context, I was over there looking at her, you know, I had somebody kind of run by and is like, we want to sell our property, and just kind of started talking about that. And it was like, this neighborhood's going to change.
We had a weird story emerge in Cincinnati this week. A local school was closed by a little critter. What happened?
Well, I feel like I definitely need to give credit to Bill, because I saw him tweet about it first.
Our Bill Reinhardt here at WVXU.
And then I needed to look into it. It was kind of the end of the day on Wednesday. A raccoon got into South Avondale School, and he was a little rascal. They had to cancel school, you know, because they could not catch him.
Yeah. And I mean, these animals can pose a risk.
Yes. And so they were very worried about feces. Were there going to be babies in there? And they needed to capture the raccoon. And, you know, they were planning to euthanize it all along. It proved a little bit harder than you thought it would. And it was like just such a raccoon story.
It was.
It locked itself in a room. Then it locked itself in a closet. I was like, how does it know how to do that? It's like, you can't make this up.
And I assume he must read the news, because like the first part of this story was the critter people plan to humanely capture this raccoon and then ... euthanize him. So once you see that part, I can see why the raccoon wanted to hide a little bit longer. And what we talked about this morning in our morning news meeting here at WVXU was that I guess they did capture the raccoon and they did put it down.
Yes.
And they are sending not the whole raccoon for testing, but just part of the raccoon for testing for rabies, because it bit one of the responding animal control people. So you were right to classify this raccoon as a rascal. He is no longer with us.
My favorite part of the when talking to the school spokeswoman, it was like, they're going to have school off? And she rightly pointed out that days off like this are called calamity days. And that seems appropriate in this case.
Well, rest in peace, calamity raccoon. Let's go to the phone lines. We have John is on the line. Hey, John, did you have a question or comment for us?
Yeah, my comment on the displacement issue of the West End seems to ignore the basic fact that that these are renters and there are landlords and everyone's free to do whatever they want under these agreements. And I don't understand why that basic legal thought is not in any of the commentary, because by being a renter, you're signing an agreement for 1 year or less, and you are free to move at the end of that lease. And that's not displacement. If somebody says, I'm not renewing your lease because I've done something else with the product, the building, or whatever. So that seems to be lost in this whole discussion, that there's a legal right here that just being ignored.
Well, John, I don't know that I've seen in any of the reporting that there's a question about the legality of selling the properties as much as just concern expressed by and for the residents who may not be of the types of means to have their lives disrupted to go out and move. Sherry, is that what you've seen as well?
Definitely. And his point is perfectly valid. But what the advocates are talking about is why should the fabric of our neighborhoods in Cincinnati is very I'm speaking for the people who are advocating for these residents, that the fabrics of our neighborhood are very, very important, and we cannot be destroying our neighborhoods. And their point is that people should not be displaced. So, you know, the wealthy can get benefits from development. And they're like, if they didn't get tax abatements or, you know, consideration from the city and people were being, you know, and they everything was like you're saying, then fine. But in this case, the city is helping. And in that case, the residents of the neighborhood should not be on the losing end of things.
Sharon Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks for coming in today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. 3 in 10 people in Cincinnati are unsure where their next meal is going to come from. And yet it's not a food shortage causing the problem. Let's talk about this story with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Mark Kernute. Welcome back, Mark.
Nice to be here, Michael. Thank you.
If you have questions or comments about this, give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and tweets there. Mark, 60 million pounds of food wasted in Hamilton County. Is that number over a year?
Yes, that's over a year.
Where does it come from?
Comes from a variety of sources. As it was explained to me, it could be, you know, not finishing the crust of the bread that's on your plate or a piece of toast, to vendors at Findlay Market producing a lot of food for an expected large crowd and it doesn't show up because of weather and it needs to be donated, to I think what's more typical is you and I forgetting that carton of strawberries, it's in the back of our refrigerator, and by the time we look at them or realize they're there again, that they've got mold on them or whatever. And it's a variety of sources, and it's pretty remarkable, and that is just Hamilton County. There's national studies that point to about 20 pounds a month per person in this country. So again, these are estimates based on what goes into landfills. And for the Rumpke landfill in Coleraine Township, 15% of the waste that it receives is food.
And you're reporting on this, which you co-wrote this story, I believe, with was that Max?
Byron McCauley.
Byron, mm-hmm. Byron McCauley. You had reported that 3 in 10 Cincinnatis don't know where their next meal is coming from. How was that stat calculated?
It's something that's put together by the Free Store Food Bank. And from what I understand, it's based on its clientele and surveys that it's done, and as well as national data that's compiled by Feeding America that's applied to, you know, municipalities in a region this large, a city this large, the national numbers hold up.
So some parts of town are now considered food deserts?
Correct. That means, there's several. The two probably best known are Avondale and Walnut Hills. Avondale, which lost its last grocery store, Aldi, in November of 2008, and then Walnut Hills, the Kroger, had moved off of McMillan Street, 2017. But a lot of creative new ways of getting healthy food to people in those neighborhoods, people who may not have automobiles, rely on buses, many of whom are elderly, making access to food easier, good food, not the, you know, salt and sugar that's predominantly sold at corner stores.
So how do they define food desert?
Food desert is the poor access to healthful food. Fruit, vegetables, fresh meat, dairy.
Does that calculate for people's ability to get to that food?
Correct.
We had a conversation here in the building just a couple of days ago where someone referenced, you know, I live out in the country somewhere, and we all have to get in our cars and drive several miles to be able to get to the grocery store. But that was the point that was countered, was a lot of these folks don't have that option.
Correct. I think the operative word there is we get in our car, or operative phrase is we get in our car. And, you know, for example, Kroger reports that it had taken losses at that Walnut Hills Kroger for many, at the store for many years, and timed its closing in Walnut Hills to the opening of the new Coryville store, you know, which again, many residents in Walnut Hills said, yeah, that's not technically that far. It's about a mile or a mile and a quarter. Yet if you don't have an automobile and you have trouble, you know, with your physical mobility, walking, getting on a bus, or trying to get a ride is a challenge.
And this same conversation is happening on the Kentucky side of the river in Dayton, where the Riverside Market recently closed. You would hear a lot of comments in the news reporting on this that, oh, come on, there's a Kroger in Bellevue, there's a Kroger in Newport. But this is exactly the point that people would come back with is, I have to walk, or I have kids, or I'm old, and it's tough to access that. So your article also talked to some organizations who are working to rescue the food.
Correct. You know, these groups called the Soup Kitchen Summit, many of them got together a little over a year ago and started meeting. And as they, their initial, and it kind of paralleled what, you know, Byron and my reporting was looking initially at food deserts and looking at hunger and the problems of access to food. And what the Soup Kitchen Summit found was it isn't a shortage, it's waste. And it's the effort and the logistical challenge of getting sources of fresh food that's good for people, you know, vegetables, fruit, to them, or getting a central location of that food before it spoils. And, you know, again, as you started off, the numbers that are wasted are staggering. And and really what this food Soup Kitchen Summit people, what they found out and kind of their working thesis is there is plenty of food available. There are plenty of good-willed grocers, manufacturers, food companies who want to donate before the food spoils and before they'd have to throw it out. Again, it may pass the date where they don't want to sell it, but it's still safe. And the point is to get that to people who need it and to provide, you know, good nutrition to people.
We recently had La Soup on this very program, and that's somebody who talked about the way that you can take some of this food that maybe doesn't look so great in a grocery store shelf, but you can still use it and make something really delicious out of it. And some of the organizations that you cite in Greater Cincinnati, Last Mile, Freshmen, Produce Perks Midwest, Block Ministries, Gabriel's Place. How is it that they plan to get some of this food back out into the communities that need them?
You know, it's multifaceted. I think they, you know, like a place like Our Daily Bread, not far from here and over the Rhine, which provides 97,000 meals, you know, a year for free, you know, the largest single day source of food in the region. It has an army of volunteers who have assigned regular routes and are able to pick that food up. So, you know, there's, you know, as Last Mile has talked about, it's using volunteers to pick up food. And as La Soup will do, it will have volunteers that go to restaurants and get the food or take extra soup that they may have produced and get it to some of these social agencies that have a food component to them. So it's really a logistical and transportation issue.
513-419-7100 is the number. Jeannie is on the line. Hey, Jeannie.
Hello.
What's your question or comment?
My thing is, even if you solve all over the United States the problem of, you know, food not being wasted, the thing is, like, when someone comes into the free store and they're hungry, I think they get some information on, like, your job status, your income. So my thing is, if you solve the food problem, but if you haven't helped a person to where they can get unemployment or they can make more money or change their living situation to where they won't be hungry or to where they can afford to buy food, is it really going to change? You see what I'm saying?
We do, Jeannie. Thank you so much for the call. We will hang up and discuss. So, I mean, a lot of these neighborhoods are struggling economically that are left with without a prominent grocery store.
Correct. Obviously, food deserts and access to healthy food is an element of poverty. Right next door, at the Free Store Food Bank, they run a program for several years, Cincinnati Cooks, which is a job training program, which has produced a number of graduates who have been able to go into, and these were lower income people, some returning citizens, you know, people struggling in poverty, who've been able to go through a program like that that is food based and become chefs, working with Cincinnati State. It has a program and get people based, you know, a food based job in restaurants. You know, I would suggest, and the caller has a very good point, a great legitimacy to that. I would suggest that, you know, there are a number of organizations separate from organizations that work to provide food or improve food access that are solely focused on job training, skill development, all of those things that lead to better employment, better wages. These are very complex problems. So I really credit an organization like the Free Store, which has kind of married both a very food-oriented, getting food to people who need it, providing that food, as well as a job training component based on all of those contacts that it has. But you know, getting this food to people is very complex. It's a difficult challenge. And then I would look at people like Cincinnati Works and the Urban League and Community Action Agency and many others that I'm forgetting that focus, that have a great deal of focus on job training that have nothing really to do with food. So I totally understand where the caller is coming from. It's a very good point. But, you know, I think this is a thing we're really trying to alleviate a major issue, which is hunger and scarcity of food.
Mark Kernute is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thanks for coming back and chatting with us today.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier, Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.